Parshat Vayechi. We're doing Parsha Summary, Tuesday night. Shpacht everyone, okay? After a fast. Vayechi Yaakov Be'etz Yitzrayim. The Parsha records that Yaakov lived in Egypt for 17 years. And the Parsha is really the last Parsha in Sefer Bereishis. The Parsha is going to revolve around Yaakov's last days, and Yaakov's last day, and the blessing he gave his children. So Yaakov lived 147 years, we discussed on Sunday, and when he saw it was coming close to the time that he would pass on, he calls Yosef and he tells him, I want you to take a promise that you'll do me chesed ve'emet, like we discussed, the concept of chesed shel emet, that this is the true act of kindness where one doesn't expect to get any repayment. And he tells him, please don't bury me in Egypt. He doesn't want to become an idol in Egypt. He knows that one of the 10 plagues that are going to come upon Egypt is the sand's going to turn into kinim, into lice. He doesn't want his body, whatever it decomposes, to become lice. He doesn't want to have to suffer when comes time for Tchias HaMeisim. We know that the person's better off being buried in the land of Israel. So he begs him, firstly, don't bury me in Egypt. And secondly, when I pass on, I want you to take me out of Egypt and bury me in my forefather's burial. And he makes Yosef promise. We discussed that the idea of making Yosef take a vow was so that Yosef would be more obligated. If Yosef gives his word, he's trustworthy, but he only has to exert himself to a limit. If he takes a vow, then he has to ascertain that it happens regardless of what happens. So he takes a vow, and really we're going to see that that's the only reason he was successful in taking his father to be buried in Israel. And then sometime later, Yosef gets word that his father is ill, and this is what we ended Sunday's class with, that Yaakov was the first person to become ill. Yaakov had requested that people become ill, and Yosef comes to get him. Yosef comes to visit his father. The term choleh, hinei avicha choleh. So it pays to note that in halacha we have a few terms. There's a mechush. Mechush means something that bothers a person. There's ke'ev, a pain. There's choli. The Gemara says, kol mechush velo mechush rosh. Anything should bother you, but not your head. Kol ke'ev, any pain, velo ke'ev lev, but you shouldn't have a heartache. Kol choli v'lo choli me'ayim. Any sickness, but a person should pray, shouldn't come to the sickness of his intestines, that'll have to be in the bathroom a lot of time. And the Gemara says, kol ha'a v'lo ishara. Any bad thing should happen to a person, but he shouldn't fall with a bad wife. So that seems like that's the worst. So Yosef gets word that his father is chole, that he is ill. That's why someone once asked me, the Gemara says, "Achash beroshoy yasok b'Torah." Someone feels wrong with his head. If he has a headache, he should study Torah. Someone said, "Go tell people in the hospital to do that."
Major headache, and I've been studying Torah, and it's not helping.
Okay, so I told him there's a difference between chash beroshoy and chole beroshoy. Chash means a very low-level pain; it hurts him a little bit. Anyways, who says that's going to cure it? It says Yasok B'Torah. It doesn't say what the outcome is going to be. David HaMelech said, Af Chochmati Amdali. My wisdom, I was able to sustain. Was David or Shlomo? Shlomo. Shlomo HaMelech said, Af Chochmati Amdali. So our sages learned from the Pasuk that Chochmah Shlamati Be'af, the wisdom I learned when I was Be'af, I was angry, I was worn out, I didn't have strength. Then my head hurt. I was wiped out. If I was able to learn during those times when things were hard, that wisdom stayed with me. Things that we have to work hard for stay with us longer. So Yaakov is told that Yosef came, and Yaakov strengthens himself, even though he's very weak, he's lying in bed, and he sits up, he puts his feet to the ground. This is an act of showing honor to royalty, to the aristocracy. This is his son, this is Yosef. And yet, he sits up in honor of Yosef. And this is a rule that our sages taught us, that we always have to show honor to the king, to royalty. Elio, the famous story at Har HaKarmel, after he finally meets up with Achav has been hating him. Achav has been chasing him. Achav is the king of Israel who had caused the Jewish people to sin together with his wife Izebel. And after years of drought and famine that Elio had promised him would come as a result of his idol worship, finally Elio shows up and meets with Achav and he tells him, let's have a contest, we'll see who's the real God. We'll have a contest between me and your prophets for the Baal. And Achav curses him, but Achav agrees to this contest. And they have on the mountaintop a whole procession. Each one brings his sacrifice and the prophets for the idols. They pray to their God and nothing happens with their sacrifice. And Elio, he prays to God and fire comes down from heaven and consumes the sacrifice. And then the people recognize that Hashem is the God and they kill all the prophets of the Baal, the prophets of this idol. And then Elio tells Achav, start heading home because it's going to rain now. And Elio starts praying that it should rain, and Achav, by the time he gets ready to go, the sky is covered with clouds, and Achav starts riding back home, and Elio runs all the way back to Israel from the mountains of Carmel. He runs in honor of Achav, he runs in front of his chariots. And that's another sign, just like in our parsha, of showing honor to the kingdom. What kingdom was this? This was a kingdom that introduced new idol worship. This was Achav who did worse than all his predecessors. This was Achav who married a woman from a non-Jewish family, from a non-Jewish kingdom, from the kingdom of Sidon, up in the north. And yet, when he's riding back home, Elio shows him this honor, he runs in front of his chariot. And this is a general thing, that we have to show honor to the king. So Yaakov sits up in honor of Yosef, and he tells him, God blessed me, and he told me that from me would come Kehal Amim, nations of congregations, congregations of nations. And we discussed that the term Kehal has halachic relevance. Every Shevet is called Kehal. The Torah says that certain people aren't allowed to marry into the Kehal. And Kehal is a halachic term. So God blessed Yaakov that he'd merit to have Kehal Amim and he'd merit to have the land of Israel. And now Yaakov tells Yosef, he tells him, your two sons, I'm going to consider them like my two firstborn. Your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, are going to be like Reuven and Shimon. So the question is, what did he mean by that? We know that when it came time to have Nisi'im, leaders for each tribe, Ephraim and Manasseh had a Nasi. So they were considered like two tribes. Rashi explains that when the land was divided, we know the Pasuk states that L'rav tarbet nachlatov, L'mat tamit nachlatov, that the land was divided based upon how many people were there. The question is, where did we take into account how many people were there? Rashi understands that every tribe gave a census, how many people they had, and based upon the number of people they had, that was how much land they got. That defined their portion. In that case, what difference does it make if the people of Ephraim and Manasseh are considered one tribe or two tribes? They didn't gain anything. They got the same amount of land because the land was given out based upon how many people were there. So if it was one tribe, they had more people. They got more land if it was two tribes. So each tribe had their number of people and they got that amount of land. But that's how Rashi learns. Rashi seems to learn that the relevance of their being considered two tribes was that each tribe had their own high court, each tribe had their own nasi. So that was the relevance. We know, by the way, each tribe had their own set of stripes on the talis. The stripes that we put on the talis are a reminder of the tchelis. But it used to be in the time that the Jews were in the desert that each tribe wore a different talis. You could look at the stripes that a person had on his talis, you could tell what shevet he was from. So that would also be relevant. What flag they have, whether they have a stone on the breastplate, but no relevance with regard to the inheritance of the land. The Ramban understands that the land was divided between the tribes. And if the tribe of Yosef was considered two tribes, they got double portion. So what does it mean when the Pasuk says that the land of Israel was divided based upon how many people were there? It means within the tribe, how did you decide which family got which section of the land or how much of the land? Within each tribe, it was divided, l'rav tarbet nachlato. The families got based upon a head count. How many people were in each family, that defined how much land each family got. But the fact that Yosef was given the right to be called two tribes, the Ramban explains, based upon our parasha, he says, what was Yaakov telling him? I'm going to give you double. Double what? Two flags? Double what? Two Nesiim, two leaders. So the Ramban says, what? He also gave him Shechem. That's later. That's later. Over here he tells him, I'm going to consider you like two tribes. So the Ramban says it must have more relevance than just that they were two Nesiim, two leaders. So the Ramban says it means that the land was divided based upon the tribes. Each tribe got a section, and then within that section, the land was divided based upon a head count. Who was the firstborn? Yaakov's firstborn was Reuven. Yaakov's first son was Reuven. Reuven, being the firstborn, should have received the double portion. He should have received the rights to being king. And he should have received the rights to being the priest, the Kohanim. When Reuven sinned, as we discussed a few weeks ago, whatever it was that he did wrong, so Reuven lost those rights. And Yosef got the rights to the double portion. That's what we just read. And we're going to see later in the parasha that Yehuda got the rights to being king. And Levi is going to get the rights, that's later on, Levi is going to get the rights to being the priest, to being the Kohanim. That's later on. So Reuven lost it all, and we'll see Yaakov makes reference to that later in the parasha. Why does Yosef get the double portion? So one understanding says that he kept everyone alive. The last 17 years of his father's life, Yosef supported him. So Yaakov, as an act of gratitude, gave Yosef a double portion. Another understanding says, when Yaakov wanted to get married, who was his focus? Who did he want to marry? He wanted to marry Rachel. So who is Rachel's firstborn? Yosef. So it's true, technically, his firstborn son was Reuven. But the firstborn from the wife he really wanted was Yosef. So that's why now he gave Yosef a double portion. And the third understanding says that if Rachel's children, Yosef and Binyamin, would have gotten two portions, then what would have happened was Rachel's children got two portions in the land. They have two tribes. And Bilhah, one of the maids, her children got two portions. And Zilpah got two portions. Comes out that Rachel, who's supposed to be the most important wife, she's equal to the two wives that were secondary wives. They're really maids. So Yaakov wanted to give Rachel a boost, to give her more honor. So he took Yosef and he made Yosef into two tribes. This is interesting because later on, once we start Sefer Shmos, once the Jewish people become a people, we don't really see a desertion between those who came from the tribes of the wives and those who came from the tribes of the maids. We don't see a difference. And here at the end of Bereishis, according to this understanding, we still have this distinction. Yosef is from Rachel, and Yosef is from one of the real wives. And then Yaakov... Yeah?
Question.
Sure.
In one of our classes, we talked about if a man has two wives, and one is a head wife, he couldn't make first bump the one who born is from his beloved wife. So how do you discuss?
Very, very good question. What he's asking is, we know that a person is not supposed to recognize different children among his children, and we also know that a person is not supposed to
marry
two sisters, we discussed. But a person is supposed to leave the inheritance to go to his firstborn, not to change it. So we're hopefully going to deal with that Thursday night. We could deal with it for 10 minutes now, but then we won't finish the parasha. So let's, if I forget, remind me. We'll try to deal with it Thursday night. What? I know we prayed our heat. I'm limited in time tonight. So Yaakov now apologizes. Yaakov tells Yosef, he says, you know, your mother Rachel passed away when we were en route, and I buried her on the road, and I'm asking you to bury me with my other wife, with Leah. And Yaakov's apology really is, you know, she got to be buried in the land of Israel. Circumstances were such, like we discussed on Sunday, she was bleeding, she died a disgraceful death, a death which, I don't know if it's a disgraceful death, but if we would have carried her around to a better burial place, it would have been a disgrace for her to be carried around when blood is dripping from her. So we buried her right away, but she got to be buried in the land of Israel. If you don't take me back to my forefather's burial plot, then I'll be buried in Egypt. And then Yaakov sees Yosef's children and he says, who are these? What's he asking, who are these? So the simple understanding is he couldn't see that well. Chazal explained to us that he asked Yosef, how'd you have these kids? Explain to me what kind of life you led before I came to Egypt. These children were born way before Yaakov came. So Yosef tells him, these are the kids that God gave me, bazeh. Bazeh could mean over here. These are the children I had here in Egypt. But our sages say it means he took out a ksuba, he took out the contract which he had with his wife, and he said, you see, I had a contract and that's how I married her. Why is that so important? Why do we care if he married her with a contract or not? The way the world ran ordinarily was, you see a girl, you like her, she's good looking. If you want and she wants, you go together, you live together. Whenever you want and or she wants, you break up. Sort of like the world was running around today. That's the way the world was before the Torah was given. And one of the aspects of holiness that God gave the Jewish people, one of the serious acts of holiness, is the act of getting married. And one of the binding factors of marriage is the contract, the ksuba. When you have a contract that says, if when I pass on, or if I ever divorce you, I'm going to give you so-and-so amount of money, what you're saying is, this isn't a fly-by thing. We're going to be together. I'm not coming with you just because I feel like it and you feel like it and that's it. That's the way the world works. The Torah didn't want that. The Torah wanted a person to honor his wife and to see value in the relationship with his wife and to stick to it and build it and cultivate it. Well, if you have nothing binding, then when the going gets tough, so everyone gets going. So what Yosef is showing his father is, I came to a land where no one's faithful to their husbands and no one's faithful to their wives. The land of Egypt, we know, was replete with immoral acts. And Yosef is saying, no, I had these children with this. I married one woman, she's the mother of these kids, and I kept a moral life even before you came to Egypt. Now, Yaakov was getting old and he didn't see so well. He asks Yosef to bring the children forward. And the children come forward and the pasuk stresses he kissed them and he hugged them. Why is that important? Like the pasuk could also say, they came forward, they leaned, they stood straight, but why do I care about the details? So there's a very interesting Sforno over here. Sforno says, Sforno says that the act of kissing the children was to put him closer to the children, and that would allow him spiritually to be able to bless them. Let's see if I could find inside. As Sforno says, here. Kidei shetidabek nafsho bahem, so that his soul will cling to them, v'tachul alehem birchato, and his blessing will come down upon them. There's an ancient custom that Friday night, after we make Shalom Aleichem, after we say Eish Yisrael, so the children come to their mother and get blessed by their mother. Even though today you see the custom is that the father blesses, the custom that's brought down in the Magen Avraham, that's brought from Kabbalistic writings, is that the mother should bless them. And if I'm not mistaken, it even says there they should kiss her. So I always wonder, why does it have to say that? So now we understand. The pasuk stresses that Yaakov took his grandchildren and kissed them before he blessed them. So we think, oh, it's a natural thing. You have your grandchildren, you kiss them. So it's true, it's a natural thing. That's true. But we see here that the act of kissing them is not just the simple sign of affection, but spiritually it's something that draws a person closer and enables his blessing to have relevance, to come to be. Yaakov tells Yosef, he says, I didn't imagine I'd see you. He says, Re'ov fanecha lo filalti. Now the word filalti seems to have the same shorsh, the same root as tfila. And from here we could have an insight as to what prayer is. One understanding says that he says, I didn't imagine I would see you. Re'ov fanecha lo filalti. So one understanding is, I didn't judge that I'd be able to. Says V'natan b'flilim. Another understanding says it means I didn't think. Now, if the word palel means judgment or thought, it gives us two different understandings as to what the word tefillah means. What am I doing when I come to pray? When I come to tefillah, am I coming to an act of thought? Am I coming to an act of judgment? Who's judging? Am I being judged, or should I be judging myself? What's happening in tefillah? Yaakov tells him, I didn't imagine I'd see you, and here I see even your children.
That's all because we're told that he was blind.
Okay, so?
So now he says, I don't see you, but I thought I was not going to see, but now I see your children. I steal your children?
Two things we could answer. We could either say, it doesn't say he was blind. It says, kavdu mizokan lo yuchal lirot. His eyes got heavy, he couldn't see. It doesn't say he was blind. He couldn't see, so it could mean he couldn't see at all, or it could mean he couldn't make out things. He saw shapes. And the second thing is that we know the term re'o, to see, doesn't have to mean literally to see, but rather to comprehend. Like Yaakov says, hinei ra'isi ki yeshever b'mitzrayim. I have seen that there's food being sold down in Egypt. He looked out to Egypt with binoculars. He didn't see it. He understood that that's what's happening. So the word roe, to see, doesn't have to mean to literally see. Yosef takes his two sons and he brings them forth to his father. And his father, who can't really see which is which, expects that Yosef is going to place the elder one by his right hand and the younger one by his left hand. What's the importance of the right hand and the left hand? So I don't know much Kabbalah. I know it's brought a little bit in the halacha. So in the laws of Netilas Yadayim, it says that when we come to wash our hands, we take the vessel with our right hand, pass it to the left hand, and the left hand pours it on the right hand. Why? So it's what Yosef brings from the Zohar, I think, that the right represents the source of blessing in the world. So we see that the right has an aspect of being a greater source of blessing. So when Yosef brings his children, he feels the firstborn is the one that should have the stronger hand for blessing. And he puts that one on his right. What does Yaakov do? He switches his hands. He crisscrosses them. He starts blessing them, and he says, the God that my forefathers went before him, that protected me, that watched over me till this day, the angel that saved me from all that's bad, should bless the children, and my name should be called upon them and my forefathers' name. V'yidgu l'rov could literally mean they should flourish, they should be plenty like the fish. When fish give birth, they give birth to many, many children at once. The female fish has many eggs in her stomach, and when she gives birth to a lot at once. Our sages say that he was hinting here that they should be like the fish. The fish are covered with water. So we have a tradition that ayin hara, bad eye. What's a bad eye? What's ayin hara? Ayin hara is you see something good happening to someone and you think, gee, why is that happening to him and not to me? Or why is that happening to him at all? So it's like you're sitting in class and one guy is munching on something. He's the good guy in class, so the teacher isn't going to say anything. And then someone else, who's the troublemaker, takes out his bag of potato chips and he starts eating. So the teacher says to the second guy, he says, why are you eating in class? So he says, but he's eating too. So the teacher, you know, once he points a finger, so the teacher sort of can't make like she's not seeing. The same thing with ayin hara. Ayin hara is that a person feels like, why is he getting something? Either why is he getting it at all, or why is he getting it and I'm not? So he's... Every thought, everything we do, moves things in heaven. The thought, why is it good for him? Well, that affects things. And God, so to speak, reevaluates. Well, maybe he's right. Maybe he has a claim. We know that even the luchos, when God gave us the Ten Commandments, the two tablets, so the first luchos came down with a lot of fanfare. There were trumpets and there was thunder and lightning and Moshe came down with them. We had the end off. They were smashed. So it's true. We understand the background that caused their smashing. The Jewish people were serving an idol, and Moshe came down. He had to smash them. But our sages say there was more to it than that. The fact that the first luchos came down with a lot of fanfare, even though it was God's fanfare, our sages say that shows us that when you do something with fanfare, it's predestined to run into trouble. And that's what happened with the luchos. So it's true. They ran into trouble that the people were serving idols. The second set of luchos, they came down quietly. We don't have any recording of special noises, no lightning, no thunder, and they lasted. Till today they're around. So our sages say, we learn from that, that if you want something to succeed, do it quietly. I have a friend who compiled many svarim, and he told me every sefer that he was quiet about, he succeeded in printing. Svarim that he told people, this is what he's in the middle of compiling, are still waiting to be printed. It's a rule in general. We know also in the service of God, the prophet says, Ma Hashem lokecha shen mimcha, mimach. What is God asking of you? Ki'im, the prophet lists a few things, and then he ends off with that, Sneh alechetim elokecha, and to go in modest ways with your God. One of the keys to serving God properly is to be modest about it. And the truth is, if a person is really interested in serving God, then there's no reason to show up. It's only when a person wants, everyone should know that I am this and that, that then he wants other people to see when he's learning and other people to see when he's doing things right. So he's putting the I, the capital I, in front of his service of God. The Chai Adam quotes a Zohar that there was a woman who used to fast many fasts, and she'd tell everyone about it. She'd make sure everyone knew what a pious lady she was, how much she's fasting. So the Chai Adam over there quotes, I think it's from the Zohar, that they said, our sages said, that she's doing harm, she's not doing any good. She thinks she's doing good, she's being a pious woman, it's not so. The Mishnah at the end of Sota and the Gemara has a listing of Mevalei Olam, the people who destroy the world. And who does it enumerate, are people who destroy the world? So it enumerates all kinds of people. One of them is Chassid Shoteh, a fool who's a Chassid. What does that mean? There's a naked woman drowning in the ocean. So he says, I'm a Chassid, I can't look, I can't, she's naked, what am I going to do? That's a Chassid Shoteh. He's one of the people who destroy the world. When a person tries to be pious, and he doesn't know the right ways, but he wants everyone to know he's pious, then he destroys the world. And the Gemara enumerates many things. The Gemara enumerates all kinds of people who try to show the world that they're pious. A person who closes his eyes when he walks, and he bangs into the wall so as not to see the women. Because the Gemara says he has blood running down his forehead, and he feels that that blood makes him pious. But he's not pious. He's doing things that harm people. When a person...
see a lot of people doing this.
What? Walking into walls? Causing themselves to bleed?
No, I mean...
There's a famous story about a Hasidish Rebbe and his student that were walking down the street, and there was an immodest woman on the side. So the Talmud started covering his eyes and focusing every way he could not to see it. And the Rebbe just kept walking. So at one point the Talmud saw he couldn't do anything, so he just looked at the wall and kept walking. And the Rebbe walked normally. So after they passed the woman, so the Talmud said, I don't understand. How'd you do that? So he said, I walked normally. I saw the woman, but my mind was on the wall. You were looking at the wall, but your mind was on the woman. There's another story about...
But you know, it bothers me with the evil wife. When I was growing up, I was not religious at all, but my mom being so Sephardic Moroccan, she didn't have, the hand kind of thing. And I would ask my mom, I go, what is that? She goes, it's for the evil eye. I go, time out, man, hold on. Out of all religions, us, we should be like furthest away from these superstitious things, right? And it always bothered me. I said, how could, God controls everything. I mean, how could one person, by giving evil eye, now have control over someone else's destiny?
It's not control.
No, but in a way, because say like the guy, your friend who writes books. I mean, it seems like somehow someone else's evil eye has some effect on.
Let's take a step back. If a guy walks up to you and smacks you. Right? So how did he have control over your destiny? A second ago, you weren't supposed to get smacked. Now you're getting smacked. Mm-hmm. So we see the fact that we could affect one another, that's a question we have to deal with. How does that work in this world? Do we say, no, I was going to get smacked. It's not by him, by someone else. Or do we say, no, God gave each person the ability to damage one another. Mm-hmm. So our effect on one another in this world is a separate question philosophically, mm-hmm. which which isn't specific, doesn't specifically pertain to the evil eye. The only thing I think about the evil eye that might bother you more is that it seems to be a spiritual affecting of one another. If it's spiritual, then...
Right.
Then, so
no, direct, I mean, okay, you say slap you, you slap me in the back. But, you know, an evil eye is totally something else. It's like, it's almost something that will, could happen, will happen, might happen. and it seems like it doesn't have anything to do with how pious a person is. I mean, if someone has an evil eye, he's screwed.
I wouldn't say it's that far. We still have a choice to do things right, and things can still work out well. But one of the ways that a person has a better chance of it working is by keeping it quiet. In everything we do, things could go smoother, or they could go in a more bumpy fashion. The Jewish people did get the luchos, but they had to get a second set of luchos. They did sin. But we know that when something's done in a certain fashion, then it could run into more bumps. I always tell guys this about dating. You're dating a girl, things are going well, don't tell anyone. If you have to consult with someone, consult with someone. But to walk around on cloud nine and let everyone know you're on cloud nine, you're begging for people to be jealous of you. And when people are jealous of you, so that has its effect. So, I don't know what to explain it other than it does.
Does that work in any aspect? It's like a little bit more special. It's like a special eye. Like my understanding of Ainara is the same thing. Like, you know, like my mom is sorry. Everything is Ainara. You know, like, oh, we're doing this. You know, like everything. The tests, studying, blah, blah, blah,
right.
Anything. Like there's some eye out there that's evil has all this control over everything. That's
no,
good.
No. The idea is the idea is that it's things that people are jealous of.
Right.
The Medrash says that when a person walks into shul, he doesn't walk with his 10 children all around him. Because he doesn't want that people should look at them. He goes to a simcha, he doesn't bring every kid. He doesn't want everyone to look and say, ooh, he's got such a nice family. I once told the guys here that there was a kid at the age of 2, knew how to bench, knew how to read. He was an amazing kid. And everyone would always look at the kid.
The grown?
Not the grown. Oh, not long ago. You're talking about 50 years ago. A little less, 40 years ago. This kid, he suddenly died at the age of 9 or something. He didn't, the Gemara says that when Hannah prayed for Shmuel, so she said, I don't want him to be an exceptional person. He should be an exceptional person in the sense that he'll be a wonderful servant of God. But I don't want him too tall, I don't want him too short, I don't want him too good looking, I don't want people to look at him. I don't want him to seem exceptional. If he'll seem exceptional, so then it'll be to his detriment.
Yes, he did die at an early age.
That's a different thing. The Gemara discusses why. Why he died at 52. It's not so early, but yeah.
Pretty early.
Yeah, the Gemara also seems to understand it's pretty early. So when we get there, we're not far.
Mm-hmm.
Soon. We're in Shoftim. We'll get there.
I'm warming up for it.
So Yosef sees that his father is putting his right hand on the head of Ephraim, the younger brother. And he thinks things aren't right here. So he tries to support his father's hand gently to go over to Menashe, his right hand. And he tells his father, no, it's not this. This one's the firstborn, Menashe. And his father refuses. He says, I know, my son, I know. He's also going to be a great nation. He'll also be successful. But you should know that the younger one is going to grow more and his children will spread throughout the nations. And we know that Ephraim, really, the whole Jewish people are called Ephraim throughout the prophets. The term Ephrati means a person who is honored. David is called Ephrati. David's father, Yishai, is called Ephrati. The term Ephrati comes from Ephraim. It means an honored person, someone who's very special. And this goes back to Ephraim. And Yaakov says that the Jewish people will be blessed using the terms Ephraim and Menashe. They're going to say Yisimcha Elokim k'Ephraim k'Menashe, and that's the Yekish custom, the German custom. Friday night, father blesses his sons and he tells them Yisimcha Elokim k'Ephraim k'Menashe, and then the Birchas Kohanim. And again, Ephraim was before Menashe. Why like Ephraim and Menashe? What's special about Ephraim and Menashe?
Special.
Yeah. Why do we bless the children? They should be like Ephraim and Menashe.
Yes, but
Torah scholars.
Okay.
Examples of two kids who were brought up in Talmud.
Very good. Yeah. Who'd you hear that from?
Well, the line of question I was actually going to ask you is learning the Chavruta, we were trying to figure out why. But then when we're more so, I don't know why do we say that today? Like, why do we say, you know.
He's saying here in the line of Israel.
Right. Like, why did we change it today to say, you know.
They could, if they could do it in the bus ladders, how much more safe.
Right, why do we want them to be there? Because we want someone who was surrounded by Jews to encourage them.
Interesting. Think of that then. So yeah, so that's one idea that's brought, that like Ephraim and Menashe, who grew up in Chutz Laretz and were successful. They were successful in maintaining their identity and their faith. So that's how we bless our children in the Golos. I want to quickly run through the end of the parasha. We're really out of time, so we'll try to quickly run through the continuation of the parasha. Yaakov tells Yosef, he says, I'm going to pass on and God's going to be with you and he will ultimately bring you back to the land of your forefathers. I'm giving you an extra portion of land, the land of Shechem, that I took from the Amori by praying when my two sons, Shimon and Levi, fought over it and pleading with God. Kashti, we think, is the bow. Bekashti, our sages understood it, is a Lashon Bakasha, a request. I requested from God to help them. And then Yaakov calls all his children and he says, gather and I'll tell you what's going to happen at the end of time. And he wants to tell them how the world's going to run till Messiah, but God hides it from him because it wasn't supposed to be revealed. That's one of the secrets. And the truth is that this is a rule for life. People think that everything should be revealed to us. Who am I going to marry? God will tell me. What kind of job should I take? God will tell me. Which yeshiva should I go to? It's true. Ashlecha l'Hashem yehovcha. We pray that God should guide us correctly. But we have to know that part of life is that we don't know the answers. It's hidden from us. We don't know when the end is going to come. We don't know when the Mashiach is going to come. Our responsibility in life is making decisions. That's what we're here for. To try and purify ourselves, to get good traits, to learn what the correct way of deciding is. But bottom line, we have to make the decision. People go to all kinds of people and say, you decide for me, should I marry this girl or not? Should I break the engagement or not? A person could help you think it through, but bottom line, that's each person's responsibility. In life, our responsibility is to make decisions.
That's what kills me, because they say that it's not that Hashem makes your match in heaven. It's like, is she the one that, like, is she the one Hashem chose for me? No, hold on, time out, hold on. What, like her?
So we'll talk about that Thursday night. We have a class on dating, so bring it up. We'll talk about that too. So Yaakov calls them and he can't reveal to them when it's all going to be over. And he starts telling each one his last words. Yaakov starts rebuking some of his children. And from Yaakov we learn that a person should save his rebuke for the end. If you'll start rebuking someone earlier, either the person will hate you or the person will repeatedly do the offense, and then you'll have to keep rebuking him. So when you're on your deathbed, you rebuke him, you did yours, that's it, he has to do his. Reuven is called Reshis Oni. He's from the first sperm that Yaakov had. Our sages say that Yaakov never saw Keri. That was an exceptional trait of righteousness, that Yaakov never had a wet dream. We see from this that the normal person does have. Yaakov is the exception. Yaakov never had. The first time he emitted any sperm was when he had his firstborn Reuven. So the average person does. We know that a person is not allowed to do anything that might cause it to happen. A person isn't allowed to have any thoughts, improper thoughts during the day. That's biblically forbidden. But bottom line, the normal person it happens to every so often. So Yaakov says, you Reuven, you are my strength, you're really my firstborn, but you were too quick. You rushed like water, and because you got involved in something that was none of your business, you got involved in where I'm going to be, with which wife I'm going to sleep, you messed things up, and you lost a lot by it. Bam! Gives him rebuke. That's Yaakov's parting words to Reuven. Must be that Reuven had what to learn. We see that Reuven is one of the people we learn how to do tshuva from. Reuven did tshuva. And nonetheless, his father felt the need at the end of his days to give him over the head again. My father once told me, he said, you might not like it, but till the day I die, I'm still your father and I'll still rebuke you. So it's true. I think that we all have to remember that. We're all eventually going to be parents. One of our responsibilities is till the end of our days, we're parents. And till the end of our parents' days, may they live long lives, we're children and we should appreciate when they rebuke us. One of the great Baalei Mussar, his father once came in and started giving him over the head. He said, why are you waking up late? Are you waking up now? And da-da-da-da. And after his father left the room and he gave him a whole long speech, his brother says, I know you were learning all night. I know you davened early. And I know you just took a nap now. And Dad didn't know that. Why didn't you just tell him? So he said, you know, you're right. But to hear Mussar from the father is always good. So I listened, because it's worth listening to. So this time I was right. Shimon and Levi.
Now that you mentioned Levi, he tells the brothers that don't let Levi hold the coffin, my coffin, because he's going to be a Kohen and his sons are going to be Kohen Gadol. Yes, he has blood on his hands, like a lot of blood on his hands. Is that the same as death? Like,
okay.
As far as Kohanim is concerned, I mean, he has like.
You're talking about a Midrash. It doesn't say it in the Pasuk.
No,
but,
okay, what, the coffin thing? Okay.
But the. It's true. It seems that Levi did kill people. Yeah, but in a time of war, Kohen is allowed to kill people.
I don't know.
So he tells Shimon and Levi, you two are brothers. What's he coming to say? He's saying, when he came to Dina, your sister gets taken. So then suddenly you're faithful brothers. When it comes to Yosef, where's your brotherhood? How come you weren't brothers then? And we say, Oy lanu. Woe to us from the time of judgment. Woe to us from the time where we'll be rebuked. Now, tochacha also means proof, reproved. And the idea is that when the ultimate judgment is going to come, God isn't going to tell us, why'd you do this and end with that? God's going to say, why'd you do this? And we're going to have answers. But God is going to show us the contradictions with ourselves. If you really are such a faithful brother, where was your faith when you threw Yosef to the pit? And that's going to be the shame to us, that we're going to be shown to our face that we contradict ourselves. And, that's what Yaakov's doing over here. He says, your brothers, really? You stole the tools of Esav, the sword. That's not how a Jew fights. And, Yaakov speaks about the future. We're going to skip that a little bit. A lot of prophecy about what's going to be. When Yaakov curses them, he doesn't curse them directly, he curses their anger. You should know that you're not allowed to curse a Jew. You should always be careful not to curse someone. Yaakov curses their anger, and Yaakov says, Achal kein bi Yaakov, I'm going to spread them out through the Jewish people. Why? They're better off dispersed. When they unite, it's not good for us. Levi fixed his ways. We're going to see throughout the Torah, Levi got better and better and better until the tribe of Levi are the Kohanim. They took that trait of being zealous and they used it when the Jewish people sinned by the Egel. They said, we're not doing this. No way. They weren't part of the Egel. And that's why they ended up being the Kohanim. Shimon maintained this trait and maintained it the bad way. And that's why the Torah ends with Shimon's sin. When we're standing about to enter the land of Israel, the head of the tribe of Shimon is the one that leads the Jewish people to sin with the daughters of Moab, the Moabites. It's a Zimri ben Salu, the head of the tribe of Shimon. So Shimon never really fixed this properly, the tribe of Shimon.
But then he was going to get spread out.
So that's why Shimon was dispersed. Their portion is dispersed, scattered.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to...
Shimon, so there's a discussion where Shimon inherited their land. One understanding says they didn't get a separate portion in the land of Israel. They only got a portion within the tribe of Yehuda. Mm. And I remember seeing a Rashi somewhere, I don't remember where it is, that says that even that portion, ultimately, when Yehuda's tribe grew, they kicked them out. They said, now go find somewhere else. And the tribe of Shimon really were scattered. The tribe of Levi, the Levim, also didn't get a set portion where they were united. They were scattered throughout the land. And the tribe of Levi, they were the Tamid Chacham, they were the Rabbein.
Levi is understandable. We know
yeah.
Levi.
But Shimon, so Shimon is something along those lines.
Oh.
Yehuda is compared to a lion, and that's important. What month of the year is a lion? Av, right? Av is the month of a lion. Av is the month when the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed. Who's the one that destroyed the Beis Hamikdash? Nebuchadnezzar, right? Today. Nebuchadnezzar is called an Aryeh, he's also called the lion. Alah Aryeh Mesufcho. The lion got up from his den, that's Nebuchadnezzar. So who can act against him? That's a tribe of Yehuda, a lion. Yehuda is the lion. Yaakov blesses Yehuda, he tells him, Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda umchokek mi ben raglav. The leadership will remain within the tribe of Yehuda, which makes us wonder why the Jewish people chose their first king from the tribe of Binyamin. So they didn't choose. God told them, this is your first king. How did that work? The Torah says that the leadership will never leave Yehuda. So one understanding says that once the leadership will fall in the hands of Yehuda, once we'll have a king from Yehuda, it will never leave the tribe of Yehuda. But even that's problematic, because we know that two generations later, King David's grandson, Rehavam, God gave a prophecy that the kingdom would break off. God said that Rehavam and Shlomo had sinned, and therefore the kingdom would leave the house of David, part of the kingdom. So the Rishonim discussed that here. Do we say that so long as there was a king on part of the land of Israel, that's enough? Or was that a prophecy only for a short period? Really, the kingdom was supposed to go back to the tribe of Yehuda after a certain period, but the tribe of Yehuda sinned again. That's a discussion over here in the how we work that out, that the leadership is supposed to be among Yehuda. Zevulun. So Zevulun precedes Yisachar. What was Zevulun's special thing? Zevulun did business and sold things overseas. They had ships, and they were sustaining Yisachar while Yisachar was learning. We have also in the Mishnah, Shimon Achi Azariah. Shimon, who's identified as the brother of Azariah. So the Gemara asks, who's this Azariah? That Shimon is only known as his brother. Shimon is a big Talmud Chacham. Who's his brother? So the Gemara says, that's a brother who did business and used to send him money. And because he supported him, so he's the one that gets the most honor. Shimon is called Achi Azariah. Shimon is like the brother of. He's like his little brother. He's the one doing the learning. You say, yeah, but he's the one doing the supporting. So we have this also in Halacha. A person is supposed to learn Torah every day. Every Jew is supposed to learn. But a Jew is also supposed to support other people who are learning Torah. And here we see that when a person supports people who are learning Torah, then the Torah, sometimes he gets more honor from the Torah than the people who are learning themselves. The Gemara records that Hillel, the famous Nasi Hillel, also had a brother. And all the years Hillel was a pauper. He was poor, poor, poor. He didn't have money when they once wanted to charge a tax in order to enter the Beis Medrash. They said, you want to come learn, you have to pay a little bit. We got to heat up the Beis Medrash. They want to check that only the right people come in. Hillel didn't even have that small token to pay. Hillel was a poor, poor person all his life until later when he became Nasi, he got wealthy. So when he became Nasi and everyone saw what a big Talmud Chacham was, his brother said, I want to support you. Let me give you some money. I want part of your Torah. And Hillel said, no, too late. Now you're coming. So that's what the Halacha says. You come to a person after he's a Talmud Chacham and you tell him, I want it retroactively to have part in your learning. That doesn't work. You got to support a person and help him grow. That doesn't mean you can't take Talmud Chacham and say, from now on, I want to have a portion with you. But to go retroactively, that doesn't work. And it's a special mitzvah. A person is supposed to try and partake in someone's learning. He himself, that doesn't mean he won't learn. A person is also supposed to learn. A person has a mitzvah to learn, to teach his children, to teach his grandchildren. But if a person can't learn all day, or he can't learn much of the day, then he should at least partake in someone else's learning. That's what Zevulun did. That's why Zevulun over here precedes Yisachar. Yisachar were big Talmidei Chachamim. They also knew nature very well. Dan were spectacular people. They had the Nasi, Shimshon, who was such a Talmud Chacham that he could judge single-handedly. Ordinarily, you need a whole tribunal. Shimshon was the great judge who came from the tribe of Dan, and Yaakov blesses him. We're going to end Yosef. Yosef is Alei Ayin. He overcame the Ayin Hara. Why is it that Yosef has this special schus that Yosef Ayin Hara can't affect him? Because Yosef didn't want to feast his eyes of his master's wife. His master's wife wanted him very badly, and he didn't let his eyes wander. He was careful not to feast his eyes, and therefore he got the special blessing that his offspring, Zayin Hara, can't affect him. The Gemara says if a person is worried, he sees someone else getting great honor. He sees someone else, things are going good. And he knows when he's going to look at him, he's not going to look so fondly upon the person. Oh, Ramchal quotes that there's no bachelor who goes to his friend's wedding who doesn't feel a sting. That's what Ramchal says. There's no such thing as a bachelor who attends a wedding. No person attends a wedding who doesn't feel a certain sting deep down inside. Maybe deeper, maybe less deep. So the Gemara says, what does a person do when he feels that he's going to look badly on someone else? So the Gemara says something, I don't know exactly how it works. Gemara says you should look to your left nostril. Focus your eye on your left nostril. Look in. So I don't know if the Gemara meant you should come cross-eyed and look at both with both eyes on that nostril, but I don't know if the Gemara also meant that a person should try to look at himself, don't look at someone else. And the Gemara says, what happens if you're going to go to a procession where you're going to get honored, a procession where you're worried people will look at you with the evil eye? So the Gemara says a special incantation. You could say, you put your left thumb in your right hand and your right thumb in your left hand, and then you say a special, the Gemara brachas, I think Dafnun Beis. I think Dafnun Beis Amid Beis, but I didn't look it up before the class. Somewhere around there, maybe Nun Chesam Beis, Nun Beis Amid Beis. The Gemara records a thing towards the bottom of the daf. The Gemara says what you could say, and that'll protect you, that they can't harm you. And one of the things you say is you quote this pasuk. Ben Porat Yosef, Ben Porat Alei Ayin, but not Tzada Alei Shul. This pasuk that describes how Yosef...
Two black magic.
I didn't say you have to do it. I didn't say you have to worry about it. But if you want...
They say both eyes on the left nostril or the left
nostril? No, it says he should look. I assume...
Is there any correlation with the left eye?
I don't know.
Just pray to God. God, please, make
the same with the left eye, I thought. Like the bad eye, the left eye.
Oh yeah, I don't know, could be.
I don't know, there's a lot of people who left that.
What happened to asking God to protect you?
That's also good, for sure. That's when you're going to look at someone else badly. Then look at yourself, don't look at him. So Yaakov blesses his children, and then Yaakov passes on. He tells them, I'm passing on, I want you to bury me in that special cave in the Maras HaMachpelah.
One of the youngest brothers, and he's the one first one to die.
What?
One of the youngest, the first one to die.
Okay.
Speaking of that, have you heard the Midrash? I don't know that the fact that he died at 110 instead of 120 because he didn't interrupt his brothers in telling him, they say, my father, my servant, my father, each time.
I think it's in Pirkei Rebbelezer. Yeah. So. Yaakov passes away, says he passed away, and then Yosef fell on his face and he cried over him. So there's a special halacha. The halacha says if we see someone who's on the verge of passing away, you don't touch him. The tendency is to touch a person when you feel he's about to pass away. And the halacha says, it's a Gemara, and it's in Shulchan Aruch, that a person who's about to pass away is like a flame that's flickering. If you touch a flame that's flickering, you're going to cause it to go out. So the Gemara says that if you touch a person when he's about to pass away, you could cause him to pass away a second earlier. So you don't touch him. Obviously, if you're a doctor, you do whatever you can to help him. But we're talking about a relative who's just standing there by the bed, so touching him isn't going to help him. If you know how to do CPR, so do CPR. Whatever you know how to do that'll practically help him, help him. But if it's just that out of compassion, a person wants to touch him, you don't touch him. And that's what we see also in the parasha. Yaakov passed away, and then Yosef fell on him and he cried over him. Yosef mummified his father, and we discussed Sunday the different understandings as to what exactly was done there, whether they kept him intact or they didn't. One understanding says that Yosef died earlier because he mummified his father, who told him to do such a thing. Another understanding says that his father said, do it to me. They went to bury Yaakov, and Yaakov left them instructions which tribe would carry on which side of the bed, and there was great honor done to Yaakov. The people all came out, each nation that they passed went out to honor him, and they placed their crown by his bed, and Yaakov was taken to be buried in Maras HaMachpelah. We have a tradition that when they came to bury him in Maras HaMachpelah, so Esav came with his troops and said, what's going on here? So they said, we're coming to bury dead. So he said, that's my spot, there's only one spot left in that cave, and I'm the firstborn, it's mine. So they said, no. When Dad was on his way back to Israel, so he gave you a whole pile of wealth in exchange for that plot of land, and you signed the contract. So he said, okay, bring the contract. So they said, Naftali, Ayolosh Lucha is like a young goat, young ram, whatever. He's running on the hills to bring that shtar. As he's on his way to bring the documentation, there was a grandson there named Hushim. Hushim, the son of Dan, was deaf. He didn't follow what's going on. So he started making signs to everyone, telling him, what's going on? Grandpa's over here. We got to bury him. It's not respectful. So they pointed to Esav. They said, that big thug over there, he's making problems. Oh, him? So Hushim took a shovel and he knocked his head off and killed him. He said, okay, now we bury Grandpa. No problem. So I always thought that teaches us something. That sometimes all the diplomacy in the world is worthless. Sometimes you just got to do what you got to do. On the other hand, we see that there are times that you need diplomacy. We see that all the brothers didn't do that. Everyone felt, let's talk to him, let's convince him, let's bring the documentation. Now there was seichel what Hushim did, because what does it mean? He doesn't remember he signed the contract. What's he going to do when we show him the contract? So I'll say it's forged or something. So there's no point in arguing. That there's a pasuk in Mishlei that says, Al Tashev, let's... No, the pasuk says, Anei ksiv keivalto, pen yechkam be'enav. Answer a fool, even though he's foolish, answer him with his foolishness, so you shouldn't think he's smart. There's another pasuk that says, the previous pasuk, one pasuk before that says, Al tan ksil keivalto, don't answer a fool like his foolishness. Lest you be equated to him. If you talk to a fool on his level, you'll end up being just like him. So the two contradict themselves. The Gemara discusses how we rectify the contradiction, and we discussed it already once. We had a class in which we discussed it half a year ago. But at any rate, we see that both are true sometimes. Sometimes you have to answer a person, you have to use diplomacy, and sometimes you just got to do what you got to do. Everyone passes away, and Yosef leaves them with a tradition. The Torah ends. Sefer Bereishis, Yosef tells his brother, I'm going to pass away, and God will save you. Pakod yifkod eschem, God will save you. And he left them a secret sign that this double term, Pakod yifkod, whoever is the real savior that will come and save the Jewish people is going to come and use this term, Pakod yifkod. And Yosef makes them promise that they'll take him out with them. And this was kept as a secret, this secret code that the savior is going to come and say, Pakod pakati, God says, in a double term that he saved the Jewish people, and that's how the Jewish people knew Moshe was true. Sometime between our parsha and next week's parsha, a savior comes and tells the Jewish people, it's time to leave Egypt. And Yosef's children, Ephraim's family, they come from an aristocratic family, they're not used to being slaves, they're haughty people, they don't feel like listening to the Egyptians, they believe this leader, and I think it says over there the leader was Nun, I think it says his name was. And he leads them out of Egypt. And he leads them out of Egypt many years before the time has come. And he doesn't use the secret code of Pakod Pakati, the double term that God saved them. And the people who follow him out of Egypt all get killed. The people of Ephraim get killed. According to one opinion, those are the dry bones that Yechezkel sees in that famous prophecy where he sees the dry bones and God tells him how the bones will come back to life and the Jewish people will ultimately live. But sometime between our parsha and next week's parsha, that happens. And in next week's parsha, we're going to see how Moshe, who's the real savior, he's coming to take the Jewish people. He's going to know the code. But the Jewish people aren't going to listen to him so fast. They're going to say, who knows, maybe he's a fake. The last one got a lot of people killed. And they try to figure out who still has this tradition of what the code is. How do we check out if Moshe is telling the truth? And we'll discuss that next week.
Da-da-da-da-da.
So, we went over.